This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Alice Carter is a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. At the beginning of this year, January 2021, Alice took her 96-year-old mother to the hospital for surgery. She was a bit nervous about the visit because, of course, her risk of contracting COVID. I mean, remember, at the time, vaccines were just coming online and only medical workers, first responders, and people in elder care facilities were getting the shot. But Alice went to the hospital anyway because her mother needed the support. The procedure went well, and they went home. However,
and as soon as I got back to her apartment, I realized that my throat was scratchy and I was not feeling so good. So I kind of bolted like very early the next morning and drove directly to one of the testing sites in Boston. And in the middle of the night, Saturday night, I tested positive. So I was pretty freaked out as a person who was 65 at that point, that like, who knows what's going to happen. So on Monday morning, first thing, and was able to schedule a telehealth visit for the afternoon to say, no, I really want monoclonal antibodies. Can you help me access them? He had not had a patient ask for this before, because this is early January. And so it took several hours for him to get back to me. And he was, you know, like, this wasn't easy to figure out, but there is a company that can do this, and they come to your house and here's their number, you can call them. So like, I got off the phone with him and I'm like, wait a minute, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, it's now been 4 days. The data is best for 3 to 5 days. How do I get this right away? And in the meantime, I'm having more symptoms. I'm running fevers. I lose my sense of smell. You know, like every day brings new symptoms. So they came on Friday and it was pretty great because someone came in like full PPE and came up to the apartment. And basically I sat on my couch and they did the infusion. They had to set up a lot of things because they brought a box that had a pole that they left behind because everything is contaminated. And they mixed the medicines and set up the infusion in the apartment. The medicine was sitting on a cold pack and it was pretty impressive. And then they took my blood pressure, like monitored my temperature and blood pressure for the full time of the infusion and then for a little time afterwards. So my insurance covered it completely. So the infusion was completely free. I definitely started feeling better. You know, I actually started feeling better a few days after I had the monoclonal infusion. And I'm really grateful that they could do it in that way because I did not want to go out somewhere with COVID and risk the possibility of infecting somebody. Like, that just seemed horrible to me.
Alice Carter, professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, recalling how monoclonal antibody treatments may have saved her life after she contracted COVID in January of 2021. Well, since then, how many more COVID treatments have been developed? Monoclonal antibodies, antiviral drugs, immunomodulators, and others. Together, they're called therapeutics. And it turns out there are hundreds in the pipeline for clinical trial, though only one has been fully approved thus far by the FDA. So today we're going to take a look at what role should therapeutics play alongside vaccines, of course, in bringing the epidemic under control. And we've got two great voices to help us think through this. Dr. Preeti Malani joins us. She's Chief Health Officer at the University of Michigan, a professor of infectious diseases, and an associate editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, aka JAMA. Dr. Malani, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Naheed Bedelia also joins us. She's an infectious diseases physician and founding director of the Boston University Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research, also associate director of the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories. Dr. Bedelia, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let me just first ask you both kind of the big picture question to set the parameters for this conversation. And Dr. Malani, I'll start with you. If you were to describe ideally what role therapeutics would play in bringing this pandemic to an end, how would you describe that?
Thanks for the question, Meghna. And, you know, really what we've seen is that coronavirus isn't going away completely. And I think this is very clear. Communities that are highly vaccinated and, for that matter, networks and social groups that are highly vaccinated are faring well, but there's still going to be breakthrough infections in people that are vaccinated. And at least for now, new infections in unvaccinated individuals. And what I think of it with therapeutics is this idea that for people who are high risk, it's an option to help prevent hospitalization and death. And, you know, this is important, not just from a public health standpoint, but also from a well-being standpoint. You know, we're almost 2 years into this. I feel that the therapeutics, first of all, help that risk of hospitalization and death is so important, but also like allowing people to go on with their lives. And that's sort of one of the ways I think about it.
Mm. And Dr. Bedelia, same question to you. What do you think?
Yeah, and Dr. Milani sort of talks about this, which is that if we're transitioning into a period of time where this virus might be with us for a long period of time, what kept us, you know, in this moment of crisis, prolonged moment of crisis, has kept us, we're still in it, we're potentially going into a new surge, is the fact that this was new to all of us, a virus that none of our immune systems had been exposed to. And with the vaccines, and unfortunately with sort of the increased number of infections that we've had, we're now seeing a percentage of the general population that's a bit more immunologically sort of exposed to this virus. But moving forward, what we've seen is that, you know, with vaccines, with reinfections, potentially in people who've had infections before, you might get these breakthrough infections that Dr. Milani was talking about. And particularly in patients who are older, who have medical comorbidities, medical conditions, there is still a risk that in that population, you might see hospitalizations. And to avoid that crisis, you know, and as Dr. Milani said, well-being, this is going to be important. But if the virus is going to be with us for a long period of time, it also means that we're concerned about these variants, this idea that virus will continue to evolve. And if that's the case, it may be a period of time where our vaccines may drop their efficacy, and we may need to update them and potentially have boosters against new variants. And so therapeutics also serve as a bridge for that threat as well.
Okay, so just two really important things there that I want to reiterate of the many that you just both just said. One is that, again, in an ideal situation, as more therapeutics get fully approved, they could help prevent hospitalization after infection. And that is going to provide also a much needed sort of relief valve for the medical system, right, in this country, which has been, under the grinder for two straight years now. Dr. Bedelia, did I hear you clearly that they could possibly also be a tool to help manage the emergence of new variants, just to be clear about that?
That's right. Okay. If you have a period of time where you see potentially a new variant that might come on the scene that may evade some of the immune response that our vaccines have allowed us to create, right? And this is the big concern. Thankfully, you know, the way that immune systems work, vaccines won't ever completely become ineffective. It's just that their efficacy may go down, their effectiveness may go down. And so having those antivirals, if there are breakthrough infections while we address those variants, again, keeps people from ending up in the hospital or having more severe disease.
Mm, okay. So let's talk a little bit more about sort of what's already out there. As I said earlier, Dr. Milani, there's only one that's been fully approved, right, by the FDA. And that's, remember, remdesivir. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. The full approval versus the emergency use authorization.
Okay. And so what are the sort of general classes of therapeutics that we're seeing that are currently under development? There are many. The FDA told us there are several hundred that are under development.
Yeah. And I'd just like to take a step back around treatments or therapeutics. You know, basically, there's a little bit of a decision pathway. You know, one is, are you sick enough to seek care at all? Do you have any symptoms? And then the second piece of that is, what is your risk of becoming severely ill? And in general, this has to do with age and health conditions mostly. And so young, healthy people with breakthrough, like on my college campus, for example, therapeutics would have a very limited role, if any, and it's more, you know, tea and chicken soup and taking care of your fever. But someone who has higher risk, they can fall into a number of categories. And the drug you mentioned, Meghna, is remdesivir. That's something that, again, we're using in the hospital with someone who is sicker. And that's a drug we've been using really since very early in the pandemic, really the beginning of the U.S. phase. And what we have are things in between, depending on how sick you are, if you have mild symptoms, do you need oxygen? And the piece that I think really is so interesting is that idea of getting at people who are at high risk for complications early. Mm-hmm. And today, you know, right now in November of 2021, it's monoclonal antibodies, which we mentioned. And of course, at the beginning of the hour, we heard from Alice talking about that. And then I think moving forward, maybe very soon, we may have oral antivirals, which I know we'll talk about. And then in between, in the hospital, in addition to remdesivir, it's steroids and it's immunomodulating agents. But by the time you are there, you fall into a very different bucket in terms of illness. And what we need to do is really shift to where we're getting at people early who are at high risk of hospitalization.
Okay. Well, we have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to left in this section segment before our break. And I just want to underscore, though, that, of course, I know both of you agree. We're talking about treatments, meaning after infection. And, of course, it continues to be true that the best way to avoid illness is to not get infected at all, a.k.a. the vaccine. So I just wanted to reiterate that, even as we try to more deeply understand what's happening in the world of COVID therapeutics. And we'll learn a lot more when we come back from the break. So I'm joined today by Dr. Naheed Bhadelia and Dr. Preeti Malani, and they're talking us through actually the pretty exciting world of all the COVID therapeutics that are being developed out there. And so we'll have a lot more when we come back. And by the way, hop on Twitter or Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And if you got any questions about COVID therapeutics, put your questions there and we'll see if we can get them to our two doctors today. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about COVID therapeutics, or the many drugs currently in development to help work hand in hand with vaccines to stop the pandemic and turn COVID into a manageable endemic disease, and more importantly, what the development of these new drugs also tell us about our possible ability to thwart the next pandemic. Because if we know anything, we know that there will be another one eventually. That's just how Mother Nature works. I'm joined today by Dr. Preeti Malani and Dr. Naheed Bhadelia, and they're here to talk us through all the world of COVID therapeutics. And Dr. Bhadelia, you know, we often do this. We, meaning us here in the media, not you physicians and researchers, but we often like talk about these treatments as if we know exactly how they work. And I would like to admit, I do not know exactly how they work. So can we just do a quick lightning round of, you know, you don't have to go into too much detail, but I'd love to educate myself and listeners about when we say monoclonal antibodies or immunomodulators, exactly what we're talking about. So let's go through some of the categories here per the FDA. So let's start with monoclonal antibodies. Like exactly what are they? What are they? And quickly, how do they work?
Yeah, great question. And I'm going to tell you how the monoclonal antibodies work, but I kind of wanted to do it in the way that this virus works. So this is how the virus works, right? The infection, the first the virus replicates, and then people get critically ill because not only is the virus causing the damage, but it's revving up your immune system. And that's kind of damaging your body beyond what the virus itself is doing as well. So critically ill patients with COVID-19 seem to have this immune system that's immune response that's maladaptive. So monoclonal antibodies currently, there are two types, actually. Monoclonal antibodies that we're talking about, that Dr. Malani was talking about, that are used in people who are not as ill, those are monoclonal antibodies that are taken from survivors or identified as being very effective at blocking the virus from replicating, right, becoming a bigger threat to the body and stopping it that replication early. And those, that's exactly what they do. Their use is to, if they're given early, if there's not that much virus in your body, they are blocking that replication and the virus sort of infection taking a foothold. So that's what monoclonal antibodies are.
Okay. And then so, Dr. Malani, I'm seeing another category here per the FDA of immunomodulators. What are they and how do they differ from the monoclonal antibodies? Or is it the same?
They're different, and I'll try to stay pretty high level here because you can definitely get into the weeds. But part of why COVID is a difficult infection is that the virus causes an inflammatory response in the body, and it's an excessive, you know, inflammation can be good, but this is too much inflammation. And so the immunomodulators, these are going to be used mostly in hospitalized patients, and it could be anything from sort of corticosteroids or steroids, or it could be these more complicated inhibitors that work at particular sites. And one of the drugs that we use is like tocilizumab, just a mouthful. But again, with these, it's this idea of that abnormal inflammation that's happening in the body to try to curtail it. Mm. So it's not working on the virus itself, but the side effect or one of the ill effects of the virus. And, you know, there are side effects using these drugs. For example, you might have a higher risk of other infection, of a bacterial infection. And these are used, they're specific criteria, and there's kind of a stepwise fashion. And, you know, again, hopefully the good news is if you are fully vaccinated, you're less likely to need these kind of medications. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm also seeing then another category here, again, FDA category of cell therapies. Dr. Bedelia, enlighten me on those.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the biggest part of trying to catch these patients early is trying to make sure that there is a response to these adult stem cells, this immune response that is not going to be, as Dr. Malani said, there's going to be out of control to what can be handled by the body. And some of the stem cell therapies that are being looked at is trying to see how we can build resilience of the body against potential damage that excessive inflammation is going to do.
Okay. And then we also have a category, and Dr. Malani, I'm going to bounce back to you here, of antiviral drugs. For COVID, quickly again, or ideally for COVID, what are they and how do they work?
So antivirals are, and as actually Dr. Bedelia talked a little bit about how the virus replicates, these are remdesivir, like the medication that you mentioned, Magna, earlier. And again, these work to really reduce the amount of infectious virus in the body by targeting the ways that the virus replicates, that it grows. And much like, and again, HIV is what comes to my mind. Like there's all these different ways that we treat HIV depending on the different sites. And so far, the antiviral that we have that we use clinically is remdesivir. But some of these drugs in development are also antivirals. And there are a couple, and I think we're going to talk about them, mm-hmm. that are sort of right at that cusp of getting discussed, and the FDA will be looking at some of these data on two of the drugs coming up.
Okay. So just again, for context here, antiviral medications have been used to important effect for such diseases as HIV, right, herpes, hepatitis C, et cetera. So an area of potentially very fruitful research regarding COVID. So as you said, Dr. Malani, let's turn now to Dr. George Yancopoulos. He is president and chief scientific officer at Regeneron. Dr. Yancopoulos, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Magna. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So Regeneron has a new pill in development that seems to be attracting some pretty good news. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
All right. Well, you mentioned how important it is to be prepared, not only for this pandemic, but a future pandemic. So I think we have to step back and point out what a tremendous tribute it was to science and the entire biopharma industry that we're all able to rapidly make these weapons to fight back against this pandemic. In our case, we started developing these technologies decades ago, and you may not know, we came up with the first monoclonal antibody treatment ever to treat any infectious disease. It was for the Ebola epidemic that was raging in the Congo. And our monoclonal antibody treatment for that was highly effective and was the first FDA-approved treatment for Ebola. It was a real miracle. And so we were able to use the same technology to try to fight back against COVID. So our treatment is not a pill. It's an antibody, like you just heard from the other guests. It's the first monoclonal antibody cocktail that was authorized by the FDA to treat COVID-19. As you heard from the other speakers, it reduces the risk of hospitalization and death by 70 to 80%, which is important enough. But I got to add that it does a lot more than the other speakers had time to discuss. It also very rapidly drops your virus levels. And thus, if you treat a person with monoclonal antibodies, it makes them almost, from the next day, very less infectious. They were less able to spread the virus. That's really important.
Okay. Let me just jump in here first and I just apologize because, yes, I am getting my pharma companies confused here. I'm thinking about Pfizer, I think, which we'll talk about in a minute. So I appreciate the clarification, actually, a lot. So given what you just said, Dr. Yiannopoulos, I do understand, though, that just a couple of days ago, Regeneron released a press release about some early findings regarding the possibility of using the treatment to even perhaps there's some very early indication that it might prevent infection?
Yeah, very, very strong data. So what you heard right now, as we heard, the broadest way to try to prevent infections in the largest population is to give people vaccines. The whole point of vaccines is they make the body make its own antibody that fights back against the virus. The problem is, as many of us know, there are people that are called immunocompromised or immunosuppressed. There are millions of Americans, 5 to 10 million Americans, whose immune systems are suppressed because they have organ transplants or they have cancers like myeloma or lymphoma, or they are treated because they have diseases like multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis. They're treated with immunosuppressive medicines. So very many of these people do not respond at all to vaccines. So vaccines are not the answer for these 5 to 10 million immunocompromised individuals. In fact, that makes them the most vulnerable amongst us. They are now constituting some of the people who have the worst outcomes from COVID-19. So we need another answer for these people. And what you heard from the previous speakers, monoclonal antibodies are exactly what vaccines are intended to induce in a healthy immune system. They are the antibodies to fight back. But now we've made these antibodies outside of the body, grow them up, highly purify them, and give them back to people. And they essentially can serve as what is known as a passive vaccine to substitute for those who can't actively respond to the actual vaccine. Mm. So our monoclonal antibodies have been authorized to treat COVID-19 and prevent hospitalization and death. They've also been authorized to protect people who have had a high-risk exposure. But the recent data that's so exciting is that we've now shown that a single administration can protect individuals for many months. So what that means is, particularly as I said, for these immunocompromised types of individuals who can't be protected by a vaccine, we now have an alternative, a passive vaccination approach, which can be given, let's say, twice a year or four times a year and protect them just as well or maybe even better than a vaccine can protect you, but yes, specifically cater to these people who can't make their own antibodies in response to vaccines. So we have applied to the FDA for them to authorize this particular use. It's not yet authorized to protect and prevent COVID in such people, but we hope, especially with the recent exciting data that we just released last week, that the FDA will rapidly jump on board and make this option available, because the immunocompromised, as you know, they've been termed prisoners of the pandemic.
Yes.
They can't be protected by the vaccine. They can't go outside. This could free them.
This could. And so that's exciting news here. It comes, though, also with the ongoing question of of cost, right? Because I'm seeing here that the, you know, one dose of the treatment can cost well north of $1,000. Is that, has that price come down at all, or will it, could it?
Well, it's probably going to cost on the order of one or a couple thousand dollars to protect immunocompromised people for a year. But you have to remember, it takes a lot more work and it's a lot more costly to actually make these antibodies outside of the body than it is to actually make a vaccine. And we have to understand that for us to be ready, for us to be able to fight disease, we have to have a very strong biopharma industry. And in order to do that, we have to be able to incentivize companies to be making the investments that are required to develop technologies decades in advance of when they might actually use them. So society has to recognize that we have to be willing to recognize that, you know, providing incentives to companies to be working for decades without making making a profit in order to develop these technologies is critically important for us to have these abilities when we need them to fight a pandemic. If we don't make these investments decades in advance, a company like Regeneron for over 20 years never made a profit. Think about that. And that was while we were developing the capabilities and technology that allowing us to fight back.
Yeah. Well, Dr. George Yancopoulos, President and Chief Scientific Officer at Regeneron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you, Meghna.
Okay. So Dr. Preethi Malani and Dr. Naheed Bhadelia, let's turn to for a moment to some of the the practical concerns around these therapeutics. Dr. Malani, you heard Dr. Yancopoulos talk about that companies have to be incentivized to enter these areas of research. I mean, that's debatable about how that incentive can come, right? Because much of the research was initially publicly funded anyway. So we've done many, many hours on the business debate over pharma, and I can't really fully enter that territory right now. But if you want to comment on it, please feel free to do so. But I do wonder what you think overall about how the costs of these therapeutics, you know, could they become actually obstacles towards us or standing in the way of us as a society maximizing their effectiveness in fighting the pandemic?
You know, Meghna, I'm glad you asked that because it's not simply just the cost of the monoclonal antibodies. It's really access to testing. It's access to healthcare. It's pharmacies. I just read something about how many pharmacies have closed down, you know, and I'm thinking not so much about monoclonals, but I'm thinking about eventually having these oral antivirals. It's having money to pay for medications and insurance. You know, it's public health, but it's also economics. And again, right now with Operation Warp Speed, the cost of these agents is covered, but it's the administration is not covered. And then the logistics, which are really sizable. And you heard Alice at the beginning talk about how, you know, someone came to her home and administered this. And, you know, presumably that was in Boston. And we have something similar in Ann Arbor. But there are a lot of places where simply the logistics are very, very difficult.
So, Dr. Bhadelia, this is a really important point, right? Because it's not that lots of people won't just be able to walk to their local pharmacy or even their local hospital, which might be many, many miles away and already overwhelmed. So what are there's the testing picture, right? Because as far as I understand, like, you have to be tested and know if you're positive or not within a pretty fixed window of time to then, if you get a treatment, for the treatment to be as effective as possible. Is that right?
That's right, because your goal is to try to keep the virus from, you know, taking hold, replicating and causing this infection. And so to Dr. Yancopoulos's early point, I must comment on this, which is that, you know, we have to start looking at a certain number of diseases that have this kind of pandemic impact on the world. We have to look at how we invest in biopharma around therapeutics and vaccines for these diseases in a different way. You know, we have to incentivize them in such a way that on the other side of it, we can get enough doses to actually make a difference when there's a crisis. And so manufacturing, clearly a cost, but the testing picture is an important part, because if your goal is to make a difference in terms of how outcomes for many, many different vulnerable populations across the country with differential access to healthcare, if your goal is to try to get them a pill or to get them access to monoclonal antibodies so that they don't end up in the hospital, you have to first be able to link that to testing. You need to know for monoclonals, it needs to be, you know, early enough that people don't end up in the hospital for hospitalizations. For the Pfizer drug, it's 3 days. You see the best outcomes if you can 3 days after symptom onset. If you can take this drug for the Merck, it's about 5 days. So think about how long it takes for people to get a test right now in our current environment. You can't even get rapid tests because they're flying off the shelves. So first you got to do that, and then you have to make sure the pharmacies, as Dr. Milani said, in your neighborhood have access to it, and they're able to call up a doctor and actually get the drug in your hands in time. So yeah, all of that needs to come together.
So once again, the overall sort of ricketiness of our healthcare infrastructure really at play here, especially in the world of COVID therapeutics. We'll have a lot more to talk about when we come back, so hang in there. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about COVID therapeutics. These are treatments for COVID and what important role they can play and should play in bringing this pandemic to an end. I'm joined today by Dr. Naheed Bhadelia. She's an infectious diseases specialist and founding director of the Boston University Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy, also associate director of the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories. Dr. Preeti Malani joins us as well. She's chief health officer at the University of Michigan and a professor of infectious diseases there, associate editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. And in a minute or two, we're going to talk about sort of really the exciting science behind the development of these therapeutics and what it might mean for the next pandemic as and when it comes. But I've still got a couple of questions for the two of you about what it means for this pandemic. And Dr. Malani, I mean, we've already seen that belief in the effectiveness of certain therapeutics or certain drugs has been the reason why many people who are reluctant or questioning or resistant to vaccination have not been vaccinated, right? And sometimes it even leads them to, attempting to take treatments that have no rigorous proof of working on COVID. I'm thinking about ivermectin, for example. So from a policy perspective, like, how do you handle the emergence of these therapeutics versus the effectiveness of vaccination overall in bringing the pandemic to heal?
You know, this is a difficult situation. Like, as you've said over and over, and I thank you for that, is that vaccines remain the most important aspect of controlling COVID and really moving us to the next phase of the pandemic. And these treatments, you know, one thing to point out is that people might say, well, it was 90% better or 50% better, but the percentage is still pretty small. Like, these are not, none of them are sort of magical treatments, and nor is vaccines, But that it is difficult because there are these different narratives that move through communities in terms of this. But, you know, one thing I want to point out is that vaccination is still quite good, especially in the highest risk population. I look at that CDC tracker almost every day, and at least for a single dose for those 65 and above, it's like 98.something%. So the good news is that our highest risk members of the community are indeed taking vaccines, and now they're getting boosted. And the good news is that the treatments, especially for people who qualify and get access to testing early, they can benefit. But it's not that this really is going to completely eliminate your risk. It will decrease it, but it won't eliminate it. Mm.
Dr. Bedelia, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's going to stick around partly, and we may see the benefit of the kind of work that we're putting into these oral antivirals and other therapies is going to be important for us, because it's also teaching us a lot about how we target these emerging infectious diseases, viruses, where we target them, and how we prepare the rest of the healthcare system in sort of responding to them, right? So stepping back, I mean, a lot of what I do in terms of the response to these pathogens is exactly the therapeutics tend to always come too late, you know, if we could discover this holy grail of a class of oral antivirals, not just for the rest of this pandemic, but the idea that we can learn to create this arsenal for the next time, those that work against a whole class of viruses, then you might be able to deploy them very quickly. What if we had this, for example, oral antivirals in spring of 2020, while we're still working to find, effective vaccines? We're trying to do vaccine trials. If you had safety already proven for a class of these therapeutics that could work against many, many different classes of viruses, we could have avoided the impact on the healthcare system. So it's for this, but also for the next threat as well.
Aha. So this is actually where the what ifs we can ask them, almost practically speaking, right? So let's turn to Dr. James Crowe now, who joins us from Nashville. He's a professor at Vanderbilt University and director of the Vanderbilt Vaccine Center, and also chief scientist for something called the AHEAD 100 Project. Dr. Crowe, welcome to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Magna.
Okay, so AHEAD 100, what is it?
Well, we've been working to make human monoclonal antibodies to infectious diseases for decades, and we're learning how to do this faster and faster. In the current pandemic, we were asked by the U.S. agency DARPA to launch efforts in January of 2020 to make human monoclonal antibodies as fast as we could. And we did that. We took a sample from a survivor and made thousands of antibodies within several weeks, and we transferred those to a pharma partner, and they've been in multiple efficacy or phase three trials, and they work, as we've already discussed with other antibodies on the call. But we started to think, what's faster than 25 days? Could we go just a little bit faster? And that wasn't a very satisfying thought. And then it came to us, well, if we had the antibodies we needed on day zero, in fact, had them ahead of time, we would be so much in a better position to interrupt an outbreak. So you could have an epidemic that was small with dozens or hundreds of people and surround those people with instant immunity if you had the antibody ready to go at the beginning of the outbreak. So that led to envisioning an effort to make antibodies for the 100 most likely causes of future epidemics. And we're doing that right now. We've launched that effort to list out the most likely causes and work on having antibodies ready to go.
Okay, so these 100 most likely causes of future epidemics, then by definition, they're already known pathogens?
Absolutely. If you look around the world, you can see infections occurring every day in humans. Many of them are zoonotic infections, which is infections that move from an animal to a person. And there are chat sites or listservs that scientists watch, and I sit watching these every day. And every day there's 10 or 12 reports of infections like Ebola and others ongoing even today. Like right today, there are many of these 100 infections occurring at a low level. But the question is, cause a larger epidemic? So we already know what most of these are. We just haven't made solutions for them yet.
Right. So just to be clear, though, in the case of something like COVID, or SARS-CoV-2, I should say, which was novel at the time of the onset of the pandemic, what you're developing now wouldn't apply to a novel pathogen.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Okay. So if you take the 100, they sort of group into what are called virus families. So for instance, one of the major viruses that was originally described was yellow fever virus. which in Latin, flavi is yellow. So flaviviruses are a group that are like yellow fever, but those include West Nile or dengue virus. Dengue viruses infect 400 million people a year, even today. Japanese encephalitis virus, Zika virus, et cetera. So you can group related viruses into a family. And one of the goals we have is while we're trying to get individual antibody solutions for each of the 100, we could actually broaden our view to getting an antibody that would cover all the viruses in a family. So Zika and dengue, or West Nile and Zika, or all of them. So that gets you down to sort of like a HEAD 25 program, if you could get antibodies that were broad. And the thought is, if we cover all the viruses that we know have already occurred, the likelihood of a new flavivirus in the future being covered by our very broad antibodies would be very high. Mm. So sort of a forward-looking, people call this breadth. How broad can we make our antibody therapeutics?
So in a sense, I guess to use a militarized metaphor, that you're trying to develop an advanced strike arsenal against pathogens that we know exist, or families of them, that do flare up as epidemics and could spill over into pandemics. So this seems pretty exciting. I'm seeing some reporting here that says, what, development costs of about $30 million per virus to test and manufacture 10,000 dose stockpiles. So about a $3-ish billion cost for developing this sort of arsenal for 100 viruses. But when you compare it to the trillions of dollars that have been spent globally, and let me just turn to Dr. Bedelia about this. It doesn't seem like that huge of a tab for something that could ideally be a very strong preventative tool in the future.
Absolutely. And it has to be. In my mind, you know, we've always, I think you've seen this quoted many times, and this comes from a report after the Ebola virus disease epidemic in West Africa, which is that we are a society that cycles between panic and neglect. And the reason we haven't done this before is not that it's not technologically possible to do this, but it's because our attention moves very quickly after an emergency ends. And as we move forward, right, the investments in things like AHEAD 100, along with improving our surveillance and, you know, better ability to capture new threats early and work on them. And there's another sort of equal sort of arm of development currently being worked at about trying to get vaccine candidates ready within the first 100 days of identifying a pathogen. All of those things are important. They are pennies on the dollar for what this pandemic has done, will continue to do to us as we try to come out of this. So these are worthwhile investments. We just need political commitment and continued financial investment.
Yeah. Dr. Crow, you know, now that we're into year two of this pandemic, I think it's easy to forget how remarkable, at least to me as a layperson, it seems that these scientific advancements are. I mean, how would you describe even the notion that you could manufacture monoclonal antibodies as quickly as you're talking about and have them ready to go for future diseases?
People have no idea the miracles that just happened in the last year and a half. And from my view, what's going on is a convergence event where you have very disruptive technologies in the biotech space, which have exponential effects each themselves. So, for instance, next generation sequencing or high throughput sequencing, in which we can determine all the letters of a DNA, that came from the Human Genome Project. And that was an investment that had nothing to do with pandemics. But now we have instruments where we can make billions of sequences in a day. And then another revolution has been called synthetic genomics, where we can take literally something like a desktop printer and print out DNA so that we can make genes or a whole genome. So we can print out antibody gene, you know, antibody encoding DNAs that we need in the lab. We can do thousands of those all in a single shot. And then engineers have been working on microfluidic devices. So these are tiny little plumbing systems in which we can isolate single cells from the human body and deal with them tens of thousands at a time. So in our work, we put together all of these things. You can concatenate or string together all these technologies. And since each is having an exponential beneficial effect, when you put them all together, now we can do things that we just couldn't think of even 3 years ago. So it's very, very exciting. And I think you're going to see more, faster, cheaper, easier. And that makes the task of a HEAD 100 now feasible. We know we can do this. We have the tools. We just need the resources to do it. Mm.
Remarkable. Truly. Dr. James Crow, professor at Vanderbilt University and director of the Vanderbilt Vaccine Center and chief scientist on the AHEAD 100 project. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Crow.
Thank you.
Dr. Malani and Dr. Bedelia, as we sort of round out the hour here, we've just got about 3 minutes left. I am sensitive to the fact that we've been talking about this in the context of the United States, and we already know about the healthcare disparities here in this country. But, of course, COVID is a global pandemic. So I would love to hear from you, Dr. Malani, about, you know, the obstacles standing in the way of therapeutics actually helping, you know, developing nations or the rest of the world that even to this day still doesn't have full access to vaccination.
Yeah, this is, thank you for raising that, you know, again, and it's remarkable to hear from Dr. Crow, you know, the miracles, the scientific miracles that have happened. But these tragedies really are at that individual family level, like at the lives lost and, you know, around the world, as you know, Magna, that people still are not vaccinated in a lot of places. And again, it's not my area of expertise, but the intellectual property issues. And again, I understand that you need to have a financial model that works to support this type of work. But, you know, what we've learned with COVID is that we are one world. We're only as safe as the rest of the world. And so I hope, you know, moving forward that we can find ways to really harness this power and really the scale like has been done around vaccines and to create systems where there is equitable access, because it just can't be one portion of the world that is able to benefit.
Mm. And Dr. Bedelia, last minute goes to you here. What do you imagine, or how would you like to see the pandemic end game here? I mean, what do you think we should be looking for when we understand that we reach the point where COVID is actually quote unquote under control and it's no longer a pandemic disease?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, we do tend to be U.S.-centric when we talk about the fact that, you know, we might be nearing the corner, right? Because only 5% of the population in low-income countries are vaccinated. And these silver bullets that we've been talking about throughout this hour, I mean, they only work so far as how many you can manufacture, how many people could actually afford them, how far you can get these, because it's not just for the, you know, it's not just for the humanitarian perspective, but if you can't get vaccines and therapeutics to where they need to go around the world, then you're not actually stopping a pandemic. The pandemic is continuing for all of us because the virus is continuing to evolve, because communities are continuing to be in crisis, and that has an impact on our global health security, on our global health safety. And so from that perspective, the way that I think about it is, yeah, we may be out of crisis, you know, immediately, but our crisis does not end until it ends for the rest of the world.
Well, Dr. Naheed Bedelia, infectious diseases physician and founding director of the Boston University Center for Emerging Infectious Disease Policy and associate director of the National Emerging Infectious Diseases Laboratories. Dr. Bedelia, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Preeti Malani, chief health officer at the University of Michigan, a professor of infectious diseases there and associate editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. Dr. Malani, it was a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.